want to mention.
Hi, I would also like to thank the organizers for an interesting workshop and conference and for giving me the opportunity to talk here. Well, for the people who have heard a version of a talk on these results before, I don't have new things to report. So the work is done in collaboration with Chan Chu Kim and Pippi Nair. Two reasons why three-dimensional Young Mills theory is interesting to study. Of course, it is easier to analyze compared to the real four-dimensional case. However, it's non-trivial enough, so any progress in regarding non-perturbative aspects of gauge theories may be useful and may serve as a guide to the four-dimensional case. Second, the theory is physically relevant if viewed as an approximation to high-temperature four-dimensional Young-Mills theory. And in that context, a mass gap that might arise in three-dimensional Young-Mills theory will serve the role of a magnetic mass in high-temperature four-dimensional Young-Mills theory. And the connection between the two is via the coupling. E squared is the three-dimensional coupling. G squared is a four-dimensional coupling, and T is the temperature. Now, before I go into the details, I would like to give a brief outline of our approach and some important results that we have derived. Our approach is a Hamiltonian analysis, and the advantage of that is that it's fixed time, so essentially the theory, we have a two-dimensional field theory, and as you will see, many of results from two-dimensional field theory and conformal field theory will be applicable here. We want to formulate the theory from the beginning in terms of gauge invariant variables, and this particular parameterization we use will give an explicit calculation of the integration measure in the gauge invariant configuration space. I mean, there have been many attempts to use gauge invariant variables, but in all these attempts, one cannot calculate integration measure, but in this case, we can. Now, having formulated the theory, the Hamiltonian, in terms of gauge invariant variables, we would like to attempt to set up the Schrödinger equation. Now, in setting up the problem, we'll see how the origin of the mass gap arises. And of course, although we cannot solve the Schrödinger equation completely for the full spectrum, we can solve it, we do solve it for the vacuum wave function. And I think this is the most important result. We have an analytical calculation of the vacuum wave function and the string tension, and we'll compare our numbers to lattice results, and we'll see that there is an excellent agreement with lattice. Okay, so now let's go into details. So we are looking at the Hamiltonian of SUN, or any group, really, not just SUN, Young-Mills theory in A0 equals 0 gauge. This is the E squared part, the kinetic part, and the potential part. E squared here is a dimension full parameter. It has a dimension of mass, and the theory, of course, is super normalizable, and that makes it much easier to analyze compared to the four-dimensional case. Now, E squared being a mass will set the scale with respect to which we measure momenta or physical quantities in theory. Now, the gauge invariant parameterization arises in the following way. We define z and z bar, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic variables, and A and A bar, the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic combinations of the gauge fields. And we use, now we parameterize A and A bar in terms of a complex n by n matrix M. D is the holomorphic derivative, d bar is the anti-holomorphic derivative. As I said, M is an n by n complex matrix. Now, under gauge transformations, A transforms this way, where G is an SUN element. And we'll see, using this parameterization, that if when A goes like this, transforms like this, M transforms this way, GM, and M dagger to M dagger G inverse. So it's straightforward to, from here, to write down a combination which is gate invariant, and this combination is M dagger M. We call it A, it's not to be confused with a script A, which is a Hamiltonian. So this is a gate invariant Hermitian field, and these are the gate invariant variables that we would like to formulate the Hamiltonian, to rewrite the Hamiltonian with respect to this. Essentially, what we have done is decompose the complex matrix M into the unitary part and the Hermitian part. So what this combination does completely kills out the unitary part. So this is the Hermitian part of M. So we can think of this field H, the Hermitian field H, as SLNC mod SUN field. Now, before I continue, I would like to mention something that will become we'll see later how this enters, but there is an ambiguity in defining M and M dagger. The ambiguity has to do with the following thing. So this is the parametrization we used, but you see that A and A bar remain invariant, they do not change, if I vary M with an anti-holomorphic matrix V bar. And similarly, if I change M dagger, if I transform by a completely holomorphic matrix, well, this is supposed to be M dagger here, then you see that A and A bar do not change. And because the original theory is in terms of N A bar, the transformation, so this one implies that there is an invariance of the theory under H going to V, H, V bar. Okay, so this invariance somehow has to be preserved throughout the theory, and this is something we have to always check and keep it intact. And we call this holomorphic invariance. Okay, now, so this gate invariant variables H parameterize our configuration space, which is a space of gates potentials, modulo gates transformations. Now we would like to go a little further and, for example, calculate the integration measure in the space script C. So essentially what we want to find is a Jacobian when we go from the gates fields A to the gate invariant fields, the gates fields A to the field H. Okay, so let's do that. In the space of gates potentials, this is a metric, just a flat Euclidean metric. Now, once we use the transformation of A and A bar to M, delta A becomes the covariant derivative of delta M inverse. Delta A bar is the D bar covariant derivative of M dagger inverse delta M dagger, where this D and D bar are covariant derivatives in the adjoint representation. Now we can go now to the measure, to the volume element. So the volume element in the space of gauge potentials is just dA, dA bar. And we can rewrite this in terms of variables M, the complex matrices. So you'll see from here that you will get determinant of dD bar, and then something which is essentially the analog of the Haar measure in the space of complex matrices. Okay, now that we can further decompose if we use the fact that M is a unitary matrix times a Hermitian matrix. We can further rewrite this, and we see that this measure here factorizes in a gauge invariant part in terms of the Hermitian field H, and the unitary part, which is nothing but the Haar measure, and will give the volume of the gauge transformations. Just to make it a little more explicit by what I mean with this gauge invariant measure here, d mu h. H is a Hermitian field, can be written in terms of the phi, real fields phi. So 8 inverse delta 8 is some delta phi, some metrics R, which depends on phi TB. So this measure here is just the determinant of R, and then defies. Okay, so this is the Hermitian part. So now we can put all of things together, all of these things together, and we find that the measure in the space of Gauss potentials is the determinant of TD bar, the hard measure in the Hermitian space, and then this one, which is the volume of Gauss transformations. So when we look at the configuration space, which is Gauss potentials modulo Gauss transformations, this completely factorizes. So we are left with the measure in terms of H being determinant dd bar d mu H. So that now we have we have to calculate this determinant, but this is a well-known thing. This is determinant we know how to calculate from chiral anomalies, but of course it has to be calculated here with a Gauss invariant regulator. But any Gauss invariant regulator will give the same result, so its regularization, its robust result, does not depend on regularization as long as we use a Gauss invariant regularization. Okay, so we find that the measure on the physical space, where we have modded out the Gauss transformations, is this determinant, which, as I said, can be calculated, and it is this factor here, times d mu h. Now, what is this factor? Ca is the quadratic azimuth of the adjoint representation, and it is n for Sun. And S is a Vesumino-Witten action for a Hermitian field, which has these two terms. This is a two-dimensional part, and this is on three-dimensional part. So we explicitly, and this is important, we have this is an exact result, so we explicitly calculated the integration measure in this space. So now we can write down inner products for Gauss invariant wave functions. The inner product now involves this measure, and this non-trivial factor here. So viewed this way, we can say that the matrix elements of the three-dimensional Young-Mills theory can be thought of as correlators of a Hermitian Vesumino-Witten model, because this is the Vesumino model. Now, looking at it this way, it puts restrictions on the way that the wave function depends on these Gauss invariant fields H in the following way. If we look at the correlators of a Hermitian Vesumino model of this form, where k is the level, then one knows from results in conformal field theory that only the integrable representations have finite correlators. Well, for example, in the case of SU2, that means that only primary operators with spin less or equal to k over 2 have finite correlators. The rest of the representations are non-integrable, which means that they give infinite correlators. However, in our case, the k here is just 0. So we have only one primary field, which is 1. And of course, the descendants of this, which are created by the currents of the Vesumino model. So this argument seems to say that in order to have wave functions with finite norm, these wave functions must be functions of the current of the Vesumino model. And the current is dH inverse with the coefficient Ca, which is n over pi. Now, there is a different way to see, to argue that the wave functions depend on J, and that has to do with the Wilson loop. In fact, if we write the Wilson loop, we see that it can be expressed just in terms of J, the current J. How do we see that? Well, this is the Wilson loop operator, and A, which is written in this parametrization, can be written in terms of fades in this way, A bar is written in this way. So you see that A and A bar is just a complex gauge transform of this. Okay, so the Wilson loop now can completely written in terms of DHH inverse, which is the current of the theory. And in principle, all gauge invariant quantities can be expressed in terms of the Wilson loop operator, which suggests that the wave functions, that all the gauge invariant states in this theory are generated by the current J. So this way, we have concluded that the basic gauge invariant field in the theory is the current J. So now what we want to do is go and rewrite the Hamiltonian completely in terms of these currents. Okay, so let's start with the potential of the theory, the B squared term. Well, this is easily written in terms of d bar j, where this m here, which will set the mass, the theory, m is defined to be e squared n over 2 pi. Now, in writing, in expressing the kinetic energy term, the e squared term, in terms of currents, is more difficult because there are regularization issues involved. What we do is, well, T, of course, being E squared, is just delta squared delta A bar. So we want to use the chain rule of differentiation to go from A to J. So this is our first term. We'll give one derivative with respect to J. And this is the second term with two derivatives with respect to J. Now, I would like to mention here that, of course, this expression will involve an operator at the same point, so the expression needs to be regulated. Now, the way we have regulated the theory is a kind of point-splitting regulator, but there is more than that. We have to make sure at every step that holomorphic invariance is preserved. So all our regulators are point splitting, but they preserve their gauge invariant and they preserve the holomorphic invariance of the theory. Now, one special thing about the regularization of this term is that one sees that the expression involved in regulating this term is exactly the expression that is used in deriving the chiral anomaly. So the two things are correlated, and as I said, this result is quite robust and does not depend on regularization. So once we do that, we find that this is just the current J. So we have now this form for the kinetic energy operator. Omega AB is recognized as the operator product expansion for two currents in the Vesumino model. So what we have is a first term, which essentially counts the number of J's, and for each J, it gives a mass M. And the second term replaces two J's with this operator product expansion. Okay, now it is trivial to see that J itself, the current J itself, is an eigenstate of the kinetic energy, and with a mass M, from this term. So we can think of this J as a non-perturbative gluon with dynamical mass. So in our theory, what we would interpret as magnetic mass of the high temperature four-dimensional Young-Mills theory is this M. Now, there are some results from on magnetic mass coming from lattice, high temperature. However, the results from the lattice depend very much on what gauge one uses. I mean, essentially, they try to construct, get the pole of the of the propagator for the gluon. So, I mean, they are consistent with those results, but none of the lattice results is very reliable to compare with. The closer to this approach is a calculation by Philipsen. He tries to construct a gauge invariant gluon on the lattice, which is non-local, so it's very hard to do. And for example, in case of SU2, his result is 0.36 e squared, and for SU2, this m for us would be 0.32 e squared. But as I said, I mean, there is a lot of ambiguity for the lattice results.
Is this the eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian or only the...
No, this is an eigenstate of the kinetic energy. So I'll come to the full Hamiltonian later. Okay, so now J, of course, carries a color index, so it cannot be a physical state for the theory. And the reason, from our point of view, that this cannot be a physical state is that this is not... does not preserve holomorphic invariance. As I mentioned before, we have at every step, even when we regulate, at every step we have to keep holomorphic invariance of the theory, which means that everything is invariant under this transformation. J is not invariant. D bar J transforms like that, so the lowest state made out of J's that preserves holomorphic invariance is a state made out of two J's, and this is what we would interpret as the lowest global state in our theory. Okay, so that would be a state made out of two D bar J's. However, D bar J's have to be separated by some distance, and in order we have to do it again, preserving holomorphic invariance. So the way we do it is by introducing here, essentially this is an open Wilson loop joining point X and Y. Now, what can we say about this state? Well, each J carries a mass M. However, this regulator here introduces many, many interactions between J's, and we cannot say much. The only thing we can say is that this state has a mass at least 2M. Each J has an M, so at least 2M, but we cannot say much about the binding energy, so we cannot say much about the global states. Now, if we force X and Y points to coincide by replacing this F with a regularized delta function, then we see that this state here, which is essentially the potential, is an eigenstate of T with 2m. And this is a result that will be used later in constructing the vacuum wave function. Now, the normal ordering here has to do with the fact that, if you remember, the expression for the kinetic energy involves two derivatives of J. So when the two J's coincide, this will give an infinity, and this has to be removed. So the normal ordering means removing of these infinities. Okay, so now let's go to the results where we can actually say something specific. And this is, we'll try to construct the vacuum wave function by solving the Schrödinger equation for this theory. So what we want to solve eventually is this equation and determine psi. Now, let me first consider only the kinetic energy part. This can be thought of as a strong coupling of the theory because the potential comes with 1 over E square. Well, T, remember, has one functional derivative with respect to J, and then two functional derivatives with respect to J. So trivially, T psi equals 0 means that psi is a constant. Although this is a trivial result, there is something interesting. The interesting thing is that this is a normalizable state. If I look at the norm of psi 0, the norm of psi 0 is this, which is the volume of the physical configuration space. But this is the Besumino-Witten partition function. And this is finite. Well, finite up to some regularization. What I want to stress here is that in the abelian case, Ca is zero, so there is no exponential damping to make that volume finite. Okay, so the volume of the configuration space is finite. Now, let's include the potential, because we want to solve the full Hamiltonian problem. Now, first, because you know, a potential has 1 over e square, so let's try to include the potential perturbatively. So we're saying that for momenta small with respect to e square, or momenta small with this, the mass that has that arises in our theory, we can treat V perturbatively. So P, in the exponential of the vacuum wave function, can be expanded in powers of 1 over m. So we do that systematically. So I will write down the first two terms, but you can go to any arbitrary order.
What is the small dimensionless parameter?
I'm sorry? The only dimensionful parameter we have in the theory is e square. This K over M, momenta over M. So the only regions that we have is momenta over M. That can be small or that can be big. That is the dimensionless parameter that we have. So momenta over E square. Okay. So this is the first term. Now, D bar J is related to B. So this would be a B square term here. Then there is 1 over m to the 4 term, which has it has a part that is 2 j's and a 3 j term. Now, this d here is a covariant derivative with respect to j. So the next term will have 2 j, 3 j, and 4 j terms, and so on. Now, I want to make a remark here. The remark is the following. This term is b squared. This term is completely expressed in terms of b, and covariant derivatives on B. But this term here, it has a single J, and that is a non-local expression in terms of B. In fact, this term here will involve a term which is covariant inverse of B. So what I want to say here is that this expression is non-local in B. I say that because there have been attempts in the past to conjecture some kind of expansion and then compare with the lattice, but the expansion that has been suggested is always local in B. What we find here is that this is not local in the Gates field, in B, in magnetic field. Okay, now having all these infinite terms, we want to try to go beyond the strong coupling limit. So we want to go beyond the small momentum regime. And what we want to do now is try to see whether we can sum infinite many terms together. For example, what we want to do is sum all the 2J terms together, all the 3J terms together, and so on. And in fact, we can do that. So what we do is we sum up all the infinite many 2J terms and 3J terms, and here what we get. This is the full 2J terms. Again, this is can be thought here as B. Of course, part of the 3J term is needed to covariantize this derivative, but there are also purely 3J terms with this kind of expansion, this kind of form for F. Now, the following comments that are important here. So what we get is, again, P can be thought is an expansion of 2J, 3J, and so on. But the 3J terms are subdominant in both the long distance and the short distance regime. If we look further, this kind of expansion here gives a smooth interpolation between the short and the long distance regimes. It is not variational because it has been generated out of the Schrödinger equation. So it, I mean, so all these coefficients here, for example, are not arbitrary. They have been completely fixed. Okay, but the important thing is that it is not just a weak cap, a strong coupling result, because it can interpolate between the two. For example, let me keep only the 2J term, because as I said, that is the dominant term. So what we see, so for momenta, which is for high momenta, the previous expansion expression that I showed you can be written like that, which is of course the perturbative limit. At small momenta, the long distance region, we get this form for the wave function. Okay, so the one single expression can interpolate, can give us both the long distance and the short distance limits that we expect. Now, let's consider the limit, the leading term in the long distance regime. And let's think of calculating an expectation value for any operator O. This, because of the way that B looks, the wave function looks, this expectation is of this form. But this can be thought of as calculating an expectation value with this action, and this action is a reduced Young-Mills action. This is a, can be thought of as a two-dimensional Euclidean Young-Mills action with a coupling G square, which is our M E square. Okay, so we can now calculate expectation values in the three-dimensional Young-Mills as in terms of two-dimensional Young-Mills theory. Or vacuum. Okay, now an operator, of course, that is of interest is Wilson loop operator. So we can do now the calculation in the theory for the Wilson loop. And what we find is, because essentially this is a two-dimensional theory, that there is an area law. So, and from that, we can calculate the string tension. So what we find is that Wilson loop in the fundamental representation is of this form, where A is the area and sigma is the string tension. So now we derive a formula from the string tension out of first principles. Now we can compare now with the lattice results. There have been a lot of work by Tepper and collaborator on string tension in 2 plus 1 in 3 dimension. So here are the numbers. For lattice, they have calculated SU2 up to SU6, and then there is an n going to infinity extrapolation of these results. These are the lattice results, and this is our results. The agreement is up to 3%. An interesting point is that as we increase n, the agreement becomes better and better. This is, as I said, this is n to infinity extrapolation from the lattice results, and this is our result. So the agreement for large n is better than 1%. Well, all these things are in a continuum limit. I'm sorry? Well, there are independent calculations for the string tension. We don't have good results for the global mass in our theory. We cannot reliably calculate global mass. We can calculate string tension. These are the continuum limit for lattice. And as you see, it's a very good agreement. Now, let me say one more thing. I'll come back to this. So this is in the fundamental representation, which, of course, says that quarks, static external quarks, confine linearly, but we can do a similar calculation for any representation. After all, essentially, as I showed you before, we have reduced the theory to a two-dimensional theory, so we can do the calculation for any representation of static external matter. So what we find, essentially, is Casimir scaling. And the origin is the two-dimensional connection. So what we find is that the string tension in any representation, the ratio of the string tension in any representation versus the fundamental, is essentially the ratio of the two Casimirs. And again, there have been calculations for in lattice, for higher representations. Now let me say something about that. What is this? These are the lattice results, k equals 2. So what they do is they take the product of two fundamental representations, and out of that they extract the antisymmetric one. That gives a stable string, because we have to find the representations for which the string is stable, because the string could decay into another representation or could join with the adjoint, with the gluons, and give screening. So they're screenable representations, they're unstable representations and stable ones. The stable ones is the completely antisymmetric ones made out of two fundamentals here and three fundamentals here. There are none for SU2 and SU3, but there is one for SU4 here, and then there are two for SU6, k equals 2 and k equals 3. So we compare these results to. The first is our result, the green is our result, the blue is the lattice result. So again, the agreement is up to 3%. And then these representations are unstable, so cannot say much about it. Okay, I'm more or less done. Maybe if there are questions, I can say a few more things. Now, but of course, future things, what we can do. The thing that we're trying to understand now more clearly is the role of the higher 3J terms and what is their contribution in the case of screenable representations, namely, if we take representations like the adjoint. Then one has to introduce dynamical matter, dynamical quarks. An attempt towards this direction is we have looked at the Young-Mills theory with Chern-Simons, and indeed there we find that there is screening. And of course we have to understand better how to analyze global masses and higher excited spectrum. So the main result here is the origin, how we see that mass gap arises, and the results on an analytic calculation of the wave function and results on string tension. Okay, so thank you.
Misha?
I don't know, I have a comment, maybe first questions or... Okay, well, I'll make a comment anyway. I think that in general there is a little bit of contradiction in terms, because in the truly stringy regime the string tension should depend only on analogy. It should not depend on representation, because when it's asymptotic already string long enough and everything is fine, there is no such thing as symmetric or antisymmetric representation. It's only the analogy which fixes the string. Moreover, in the stringy picture, if you develop, say, go from the string side, and you have two walled sheets for fundamental strings, and they exchange a closed string, the expansion can run only in powers of one Atlagian. Of course, Atlagian, you will have that analogy two string is equal to twice analogy one string, and then there are 1/n corrections, but these corrections always run in powers of 1/n squared, not 1/n. because it's g string squared, so it's 1
we
over
n. We see the 1 over n squared too.
So, but no, there is should, in the truly asymptotic regime, if it is a genuine string, okay, or long, long flux tube, which already exists for a long time, first of all, the tension should depend only on annulity, and if on lattice it doesn't depend on annulity, that's too bad for the lattices. That means that their size is not long enough to measure the tension, okay? And second of all, there should be no 1 over n correction, and in this sense, Casimir scaling is just incompatible with any stringy ideas, with stringy ideas. There were, I mean...
Well, the correction here that we find is 1 over n squared.
No, in Casimir coefficient, it's 1 over n. If you expand Casimir coefficient in powers of 1 over n at large
n... Are you talking about this sigma, the string tension?
Yeah, let's say sigma 2.
This formula here for the string tension is true for any n.
So yeah, but I want to expand it in powers of 1 over n.
Yes, if you expand this, the first expansion is 1 over n squared.
No, if it is Casimir, you can see that it's not. And it's not Casimir scaling.
I'm talking about the fundamental.
No. Fundamental, I'm speaking about K string. Let's say we take analogy 2 string and divide it by 2 fundamental string tension. The result at large n goes to 1. At very large n, the result is goes to 1, because analogy 2 string tension is twice the fundamental string tension, and corrections are 1 over n squared. And Casimir gives you corrections 1 over n. So it's incompatible with stringy ideas.
Okay,
it's a common, so...
Maybe we can discuss this in the discussion session tomorrow.
Let's hear the questions first, and we'll come to
that. Okay, Edward.
Yeah, I have a question. I really followed like 80% of this, and then I lost you at some point. So I want to ask about it. When you have this strong coupling expansion, you keep on, so everything that you express as a function of this J is understandable. Then you have kinetic and potential, then you start expanding. That is also understandable. And after that you say, and now I resum diagrams and get that answer. So which diagrams you resum?
So you think of it as a resummation over number of j's. So you resum the 2j terms, the 3j terms, the 4j terms, and so on. Okay, so in the final... infinite many diagrams, infinite many terms. So you can actually resum all the 2j diagrams, all the 3J diagrams, at any order. Of course, beyond some order, it becomes quite cumbersome, but in principle, you can resum. So in the final expression that I showed you... Yeah, so... this was the expression here. So this is thinking... treating potential perturbatively. So you find a 2J term, the next term that comes as 1 over m to the 4, there is a 2J, a 3J term. The next one has a 2J, 3J, 4J, and so on. Now what you do, what we did is we resum the full 2J term. So this expression that I showed you here is the resum... I'm sorry? Okay, so this one is the full 2J, all the 2J, infinite many 2J terms. This expression here is infinite many 3J terms. Now, you see, of course, that here, in order to make this covariant, part of the 3J term have to absorb to covariantize this expression. And also you see from here that the 3J term is subdominant in both long and short distance regime. Okay, so the calculation for the string tension has been done with this term here, the 2J term. But these are infinite many terms that we have summed up.
If one just does answer analysis, if you just do answer analysis, you get what are surely can only be described as surprisingly good results for the string tensions you showed us, but there's a whole list of real puzzles, right? You commented about the difficulty of seeing screening of adjoint representation loops. There's also things like connected correlators of two equal time Wilson loops, right? In your approximation, which is just equivalent to two-dimensional gauge theories, those identical vanish.
Well, not quite. The two-dimensional theory is for expectation values long distance.
Fine. So let me consider the correlator of two large but very far separated Wilson loops.
Yes.
So in that sense, you have a that could be interpreted as a way to extract the blue ball mass.
Yes.
And so your prediction is infinity. There's also things like the expectation
No. The prediction is not infinity, but I will correct that.
Add one other thing and then ask you to comment. The third thing that I find puzzling is just in the expectation value of a single large planar Wilson loop, there should, of course, be a Luescher term, which physically must come from fluctuations, but with this approximation to the vacuum wave functional, there's no transverse dimension,
no.
So I presume there's no Luescher.
No,
so
that is not true. Let me comment on the last thing. So this is the 2J term. Now, I can, if I use this full, this term as it is, with the momentum dependence here, to calculate expectation value of Wilson loop, there will be momentum dependence. In order to extract the string tension, what I did is I took, thinking of very long Wilson loops, then the momentum dependence completely drops. So for infinite big loops, I only get the string tension. In principle, if I keep the full term here with the momentum dependence, I could see corrections to that, and that could be the Luescher term.
Do you know what you get? Coefficient.
We have not done that yet. We just took the long distance limit for this and calculating the Wilson loop. But that is something that we should look at that. But it does not mean that Wilson loop is not, Luescher term is not there, because in doing that we took the long distance limit where the momentum is not there, momentum dependence. Okay.
It seems to me, I may be wrong, that the wave function effectively, what you are using, is very similar to this variational wave function which Samuel was using in the same model.
Who was using?
Samuel. He used a variational wave function, calculated string tension, global mass ratios, and other stuff, like the string tension divided by the coupling constant square. So he got good results for the string tension, and he got very bad results for the global masses, very similar wave functions, it seems to me. So do you have any comment on that?
Not on the Samuel work, but what I want to emphasize here is there is no variational approach here.
I understand
that. The vacuum wave function, especially the coefficient, that here, which controls the string tension,
but
is fixed
effectively,
for us.
But effectively, it will act like a kind of a variational wave function in the actual calculation.
Why you say that?
Oh, because you are expanding in the gradient square or the 1 over m square, and you are keeping just, you know, the leading terms.
Yeah, but for
I mean, you know, you can always view a variational wave function as, you know, a first term in some basis in a perturbative expansion.
Yeah, but the other terms should be reasonably down, and what we are saying here is that for long.
I understand that, but what is surprising is that this other guy is using a very similar wave function, it seems to me, and getting very controversial results.
As I said, we cannot say anything right now about the global mass, so I cannot.
Okay, we also. Is there any other question?
So I have a simple question. What are the error bars for the latest data with which you compare your predictions?
Sometimes it's hard to decipher from the lattice results what is the error bar. But my understanding is that it's quite small.
Don't look for error bars. Those are very
Okay.
Yes, it's quite small in the three-dimensional case.
I'm sorry, I haven't heard, but suppose, well, it's a little bit strange, but suppose indeed they're able to calculate string tension with three digits. Then you should attribute the difference between your predictions and experiment to theoretical side. Now, how do you estimate the accuracy of your own theoretical predictions?
Okay.
How would you estimate it if you didn't know latest data?
Okay, so the best results that I showed you have a discrepancy of about 1%. So let's try to understand what, suppose we believe exactly that the lattice results are exact, why do we find this discrepancy? Now, as I said, in calculating the string tension, we essentially took the 2J term only, the B squared term, the 2J term. Now, we have 3J terms. Now let's ask, how do the 3J terms can contribute? So there are two ways that can contribute. Maybe if I can write here, you can.
My question is more simple. What is the parameter? Small parameter
perhaps? Yeah, I'll explain. If I can, is it possible to, or maybe I have a transparency.
Can you do it quickly? Because we are.
Yeah, okay. Transparencies. So essentially, for the big, the Wilson loop we have these diagrams here when we have the 2J term only. However, we have 3J terms that we neglected for the long distance because they're subdominant for large K, for small K. So what could the 3J terms do? Well, the 3J terms, for example, could contribute diagrams like that, that we could normalize what we call a square. Okay, that's so. There may be a correction to what we call a square and what the lattice call a square. So there could be a renormalization effect from the 3J terms. And of course, now, if that was only the case, then the ratios of the tensions compared to the lattice should be exact, because this does not depend on any representation. Okay? However, we see that there is still, even in the ratios of tension, that there is some 1% difference. The other contribution for the 3J terms would be something like that. Now, because of the structure of the 3J terms, we expect these terms to be down if we take long loops. But, okay, so this is the possible contribution of the 3J terms that we can see can give some variation. And also, these are the terms that are important for screening.
We are running out of time. So let's thank the speaker again. And we will discuss this point in the discussion session.